and welcome to Spark Your Fire podcast with Jazz and David. The term FIRE here stands for Financial Independence, Retire Early. It boils down to the desire to live more frugally and make your money work harder for you in order to be able to retire from your full-time job as soon as possible. Are you ready to spark your fire? Well, here's your host, Jazz and David.
Okay, hi everyone. It's welcome to another episode of Spark Your Fire. I'm your host, David Shee, and we've got Jazz Dana here as a co-host. Jazz, how are you doing?
Really good, David. Another episode. Really excited. We've got Luke today on the show, who's going to share his investment journey. G'day, Luke. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks for having me on.
So, Luke, you have obviously been in the property space for a fairly long time. Just give us roughly how many years are we talking here, mate?
We're talking, it's up to 17 years now, so it's been quite a journey.
17 years. So you have been surely in the game longer than we have, to be honest. The purpose of today's podcast, Luke, was to bring you onto the show and let our listeners hear some of the stories from you, because you live and breathe property. What's the current portfolio like of yours in terms of total dollar value?
Total dollar value probably sits somewhere around about $11 million in current value.
$11 million. And what does the debt looks like roughly? How much debt have you got in the portfolio?
The debt's around probably $7 or $7.5 million at the moment. So that encompasses a total of our 30 properties that we have in our portfolio. You've got to remember my wife as well.
Well, fair enough. Good on her.
And is the portfolio across Sydney, Melbourne, across Australia?
It's across Australia. Yeah. So one in Perth. There's probably four or five, I've got to remember, in Victoria. Some on the central coast of New South Wales, nothing in Sydney. So that's always a good one for me to say right now in the current market. And the majority of them are up in Queensland.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about the journey, mate. How did it all got started? I mean, 11.5 mil, that's a pretty decent sized portfolio with 30 properties. You've done awesomely well, to be honest, and your debt situation is pretty good as well. So tell us, how did you got started in this game, and what kicked the journey inside you of that you want to be a property investor?
Well, thank you first for the kind words. It's been a really good journey. I think it all started out with a little bit of shock horror, I would say, on my first purchase. And I think the lessons which a lot of our, a lot of the experienced investors go through on, the sore points of that first property. So for me, it was making a purchase in Western Sydney out of Blacktown. So for others that don't live in Sydney, it's probably about 35 kilometres west of the Sydney CBD. And I bought that property at the peak of the market, probably very similar conditions to probably about a year ago, before we had the substantial fall in the market by 10% in Sydney. So bought that property for about $245,000. And that property probably didn't grow between 2002 to about 2012. So there was probably some fluctuations in the market. But really, that was a massive lesson for me of buying in the peak markets. And there was a couple other lessons learned. Firstly, I tried to manage that property on my own. That was quite a number of lessons learned in that regards, because there was, holes in the wall, tenants paying late, all those dramas that you hear about, those horror stories that you hear about that investors go through. So that was probably the beginning of my investment journey. Probably what took me to the next stage was in regards to having that realization of education was required. So I started reading books, attending property seminars, and really getting myself into a deep dive situation into property investing, talking to everyone about, what I can do, how I can move forward, even going to the extent of enlisting myself into boot camps where I was paying for education. I think that's a crucial part for investors. If you really want to make this a journey for you, make it towards financial freedom, and really getting in intense in terms of what property can deliver for me in future. Then I got to the point of taking those educated risks and moving forward with property purchases, and then developing the property portfolio from there.
just to step back a little bit. So first property in Blacktown was 2002.
Yes.
Is that around the same? Okay. So 2002, and at what point in time did it spark you to say, okay, well, I need to get educated, and what sparked that?
It was actually quite a long while. So it was probably about 8 or 9 years later before I took the next step into the property investment journey. And talking to probably like-minded people, other people that had investment properties, they could see something in me that I was, looking to invest and not, looking to work at my 9-to-5 job for the rest of my life. And having those conversations and reading some of the emails that I was getting through on blogs that were happening in the property market, I really got a sense that I needed to do something. So attending some of the seminars, I really got a good sight of where I wanted to take the journey for me. And then I started making those moves.
That's great. That's great. Wow. Okay.
So what was the next purchase, Luke, after that?
The next purchase, I actually got into a little bit of vendor financing. So not your typical buy and hold strategy. It's kind of like a rent to buy for those viewers, and probably needs another podcast to explain that whole idea and strategy. But it was a situation where you can actually put someone into a property and put them on a 5-year contract where they can start to pay down some of that property price. And then in the 5 years after that, then they get to a point where they can refinance with a traditional bank. So that provided a person coming into the property with the opportunity of actually getting into their own home on a contract basis. And then a situation for me where I got higher cash flow from the property. And that all resulted from a boot camp that I attended back in, I think it was 2010, 2011. And that really sparked me into that journey of starting to think about, oh, I can really actually, if I get a few of these properties, I can actually leave my 9-to-5 job and take on property investing full time.
Sure. So that was positive cash flow using the vendor financing strategy.
It was.
Whereabouts was the property?
The property was in Blacktown as well.
Blacktown, okay.
So it was still in Sydney, but I thought I figured that from my past experience in Blacktown, knowing that I bought at the peak of the market, knowing that things were changing in Blacktown where there was a lot more buyer interest, things have been stagnant for quite some time. I saw the opportunity there, and I actually purchased that property where I was the only one at that auction. They opened the envelope, showed me the reserve price as I was the only bidder, and then we end up coming to a point where the price of that property was halfway between what I offered initially and what their reserve price was. So that tends to seem to happen with negotiations, but made some really good money out of that property. So
that's a great outcome. Was the auction day one of those rainy, thunderstormy days, and it just happens to be you the only one turning up?
It was a sunny day, actually, and I think in that marketplace at that time, there's a lot of people in the Blacktown market looking for opportunities with granny flat potential.
Sure. Yep.
So this one had a pool in the backyard, so it would have cost them a lot more to build a granny flat. So it goes back to competition. So that's a big factor when, looking at negotiations, looking at some of the property deals around, investors really want to get a good sight of, what people are looking for right now. Is that going to inflate the prices when you're looking to negotiate on a property? So I was able to take myself away because we didn't really need the granny flat potential to do a vendor finance, rent to buy deal. Mm-hmm. And I could secure a property quite significantly under market value as opposed to what everyone was buying on, similar properties in the area.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that was a great strategy for using vendor financing. And how many properties did you go through with vendor financing using your strategy?
Then we got up to 16. And now 6 of those properties have actually either financed out or then put back onto the market where they're being resold through a traditional real estate agent. So there's different strategies to use for a buyer's perspective or from an investor's perspective in that regard. So, they have a choice to take on the property and refinance with the bank, or if they decide that's not for them, and then they can actually put it back onto the open market and then, let the market, and then we do our splits from there on what the price has been organized up front.
Mm.
Yeah, so we don't want to go too much into detail of the vendor financing, but just quickly for the listeners, if you can at a very high level explain, Luke, what is vendor finance?
Yeah, so it's a situation, like I said earlier, a contract for 5 years where a buyer doesn't have the capability of going in and getting a traditional bank loan, and then, you know, they have a smaller deposit available to secure a property. And then we put them on a 5-year contract, and then they start to pay us weekly, and then start paying down part of the price of the property. And then when it comes to 5 years' time, hopefully there's been capital growth, or they've manufactured growth in the property by, you know, doing some renovations, putting a deck on, whatever it might be. Then they can take that property and get a valuation to the bank to actually refinance out, and then they take over title of the property at that stage. They have an option anywhere between the time that they set the contract up to the 5-year mark to actually refinance that out. So it's an option to purchase, you know, when they're ready.
Sure. So 16 properties using vendor finance, that's a pretty good number. Is that strategy, do you think vendor finance strategies can still work in today's market, or it was more back in the old days when you did it that it was more appropriate and it's not going to really play out if someone wants to have a think about it?
Well, in this marketplace right now where finance is tight, it's a strategy that is going to make itself available to people getting into the market. And there's, you know, the great Australian dream is for people to own their own property. And if people don't have the capability of getting an $80,000 or having an $80,000, $100,000 or $150,000 deposit right now, perhaps that could be a strategy for them. So they're paying, you know, higher rates initially, but it's really something that they can get themselves started and get them, it's kind of like a savings plan for them to set themselves up for the future. You've got options. Yeah. So, you know, that's the capability of buyers. Everything's set up front, so there's no guessing about what's going to happen. Everyone's really clear on the terms and conditions of the contract, and then, you know, the buyer knows what's going to go on, and they can choose what they do in future. As long as, you know, they're making the regular repayments and then they complete on the contract, then everyone's happy.
Right. So after the first property, which was purchased in 2002, you went and bought 16 properties, which were all vendor financed, correct?
Yeah. And then in between that, I guess I realized that, you know, the high cash flow properties with the vendor finance. And then there was a realization that, okay, when all those end in that 3 or 5 year term, what am I going to have left? And that there was a situation then I just thought, okay, I need to have a look at getting some capital growth. You know, look to a buy and hold strategy. And then I started to look to the ways I could do that. So I was going to many property seminars to see what can be my next move in the buy and hold strategy. And I met up with a buyer's agent who actually I worked with at that time to actually increase my property portfolio. I was buying some on my own, and I was buying, you know, others through buyer's agents as well.
Right, okay. So basically you started solo, and then down the line as you were growing, you brought a team into play, which is one of them being the buyer's agent, obviously. If these properties didn't go up in value that much, Luke, did you have an exit strategy in place of what you were going to do? Or you always knew that the property market was going to do well in Sydney because of your knowledge and the time that you spent educating yourself?
So the way that they're structured gives availability where the buyer is actually paying part of the property down as they go each and every week. And they've also put a deposit up front as well. So there's a lot of, you know, risk factor in making that deal start up and making sure that we are actually paying down that property over time. And if they're doing things like a renovation and adding value to that property, we're definitely going to find the valuation in 5 years' time is going to be significantly higher than what they purchased it for.
So there were a few things baked in that. One is obviously, well, renovation is always, if there was any renovations done, then the value was going to add up, plus the higher interest rate that they were paying at the very start was going to help you build that buffer, basically, of equity, that even if the property prices didn't go up that much, then you'll still be able to pull yourself out without losing any money. Fair to say?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right. That's awesome. So 30 properties made. If we start discussing every single property, then we'll probably be here for forever. So tell us after that, maybe after the vendor finance, 16 properties that you did, what happened after that? What's the journey like?
Definitely there was a feeling that the Sydney property market was actually delivering a lot of risk in the marketplace. You know, probably even through 2015 was a probably significant one for me. There was a lot of tightening of finance during that time. I sense that, you know, after that, looking back now, that they actually let the finance a little bit looser after 2015 through 2016. But I just thought that there was too much risk because the prices were going up too fast. And the whole idea for me was about buying interstate. So buying interstate for me was something foreign. So I needed to really get my team in place. And that was the big kicker for me to get things started. And a big message that I heard through the team of people that I work with, so buyer's agent, mortgage broker, and others that were on the team, was around that, you know, finance is really easy right now, and you want to take this opportunity to buy, you know, as much property as you can right now. So I was out there just purchasing as many properties as I could, and it was the whole idea about buying interstate for me was because it was so foreign and I really didn't know the areas, I needed to get a team in place. And that's why I engaged the services of a buyer's agent to actually go and help me. And once we got started and I initially purchased a property for $180,000, which was up in Brisbane, just a two-bedroom townhouse, that sparked me into building up that portfolio from there, getting more comfortable with interstate purchases and knowing that the team provided all the information for me and the security of having an investment that was actually going to perform in future, whether that's sort of the cash flow side or a growth side.
So sure. That was Brisbane from that point onwards, and you started accumulating in Brisbane, is
yes.
That right? Okay, and how many in Brisbane from that point?
I think I have about 15 or 16.
15 or 16 in Brisbane, okay.
Yeah.
And then you still also mentioned you've got one in Perth. Is that the recent acquisition? Or
that was a Better Finance.
That was a Better Finance one, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, which year was the Perth one in, mate? Is that something recent?
It was, I think, 2015. So, like you learn through these lessons as you go along as well. Because that property, I actually put a request a discount on that by about $45,000. And that property has actually come down in price further from that. So, you know, I guess we'll see, you know, how that works. There's a potential on that particular property for the buyer who lives in there to actually do some renovations. It's a larger block, so they can potentially look to add a granny flat, subdivide, and things like that might have an opportunity for them to do that. So it's a sense that they could add value to it. And, you know, if it comes to that price time of 5 years, you know, it might be a situation that we look to either extend the contract, renegotiate with the buyer in there. So, you know, lessons learned in that Perth market for sure. And I think as a buyer, we're always learning those lessons as, you know, buyers, investors, homeowners as well.
Sure.
I'm curious, why Perth at that in 2015? I mean, because you've been buying a lot of them in Sydney, like by the sounds of it, in Queensland.
Mm.
So how come only that one is vendor financing in Perth?
It was more, we have a situation where there's, you know, people that I work with in that space or actually have buyers come to them,
okay,
looking for a certain location,
right,
and then they actually go out and then pick the property. So as a benefit to that they've pick the location. We do a due diligence around that, and it wasn't expected. I guess, you know, there was always a thought that Perth would come back at some stage, and because there's the length of time on our contracts, you know, there's not a huge worry in terms of that sort of, you know, stacking up. But if it's a case that the people are employed and they're actually getting a wage through, then they should be able to get themselves in a savings plan to actually get them to refinance out in 5 years.
Sure. So what's the overall portfolio like at the moment in terms of is it neutrally geared? Is it positive geared? Is it negative geared? What's the situation at the moment? Luke, I mean, how do you manage this size portfolio of 30 properties?
Yeah, it's a good question. The portfolio is positively geared at the moment. I think definitely the vendor finance provides a lot of that cash flow and positive gear scenario. I would say that the buy and hold properties are somewhere between slightly negative, neutral, or slightly positive overall. So, you know, that's the makeup of my property portfolio. In terms of the actual property, managing the property portfolio, there probably isn't too much that actually happens. You know, we get the statements each month and input the data in spreadsheets just to keep account of what's going on. And there is, you know, the emails that come through or the phone calls that come through every now and then in regards to repairs and maintenance or tenants leaving and to look for a new tenant. So there's actually not too much. I would say maybe there's 30 minutes a month that gets spent on each property. So not significant.
No, that's pretty decent.
That's pretty impressive, I have to say. I don't know about you, Jazz, but I get quite a bit of text and calls from PMs from time to time about, you know, tenants leaving or there's damages and that kind of stuff. So given that you've got 30 under your belt and then only spending 30 minutes, and so you must have got really a trusted team. You put a trusted team and especially accountability onto the PMs to act on your behalf. Do you put something like, for example, if it's an urgent repair, less than $400, for example, or two weeks of rent, they just say, get it done, don't even need to run through me. Do you have systems in place like that?
I actually like to see all the repairs.
Okay.
So I actually want them to email me
Every single thing, you need to be on top. Okay.
That's right. Or, you know, if there's a sense that it's an urgent repair, obviously they need to repair it and they'll just email me saying, we're getting someone to do that. And I'll just go proceed or okay.
Awesome.
And I guess it's about communicating with your property managers really quickly. So if something comes through, review and then say, yep, go ahead. And I will pretty much do... Well, I think I do pretty much all the repairs that come through, and it's just a case of just actioning it really quickly and just being aware of what's going on. I think that keeps property managers really accountable. So that's an important one for me, just to keep on top of that and to know what's going on in each and every property.
Yep. So obviously all these properties are being managed by property managers. You don't manage any of these properties.
That is correct. I would never manage properties.
So that's a good tip for the listeners. Never manage your properties, I guess.
I'm sure Luke's got some other tips that I want to share for self-managed properties, but we can leave that for another episode later down.
Jazz and David, I would say that the whole purpose of it, not only does it, for someone to do the repairs and maintenance and so forth, but it gives you an arm's length relationship with your tenant. So if there's any emotional baggage that's going on with the tenant at the time, or they can't pay the rent for that week, there's an arm's length deal that the property manager puts in place with discussions with the tenant. So they can, you know, say that the tenants or the landlord's still got to pay a mortgage, you need to pay your rent. So that puts me away from any situation where you feel sorry for someone in their circumstances. Obviously, the property manager is going to put, if someone is in dire straits for a week and then they can prove that they can put the rent in the second and third week or have some sort of payment plan, well, then I'm going to probably accept that sort of situation. So...
Yeah, so you basically emotionally disconnect from that place and people, so you can make the more business decisions, which is all based on the numbers kind of thing, essentially.
Well, that's what investment's all about. It's about the numbers.
100%.
100%, exactly.
So in terms of cash flow control, because you've got like 30 properties under your belt, do you have a big complex spreadsheet that you just keep monitoring on a month-by-month basis in terms of saying, is this property making me a loss, is this property making me a gain, and what sort of repair cost can I afford, have you set a repair budget, that kind of stuff? So do you have a system of control of that?
I think each individual person is quite different.
Mm.
Funnily enough, I'm not really a numbers person and like high detail, which maybe some mathematicians are or scientists are.
Sure.
I'm probably a bit of a, you know, big picture feel person, and you know, I look at high level numbers. So if I've got my big thing is, do I have enough buffer in place?
Yep.
Do I have enough cash in my account? If something goes wrong with a property, the money can be accessed quickly to actually do a significant repair or whatever it might be. So I know that the cash flow, a certain amount of cash flow is going to come through every month. And if a repair needs to be done or something significant happens, I'm going to have the money for it. So if I've got the cash, I'm not really worried about the repairs and maintenance of various properties. And, it's really interesting to be someone who is involved in property heavily with 30 properties and not be, high detail on the numbers, but look at high level and what's the direction of the portfolio, what's the next purchase going to be like, am I supplementing cash flow, or am I looking for a capital growth or a development opportunity? So all these things that I keep a note on.
Sure, that's a good point, actually. So how much money do you keep in your offset account? Maybe it's a percentage of the portfolio that it's going to be 10% you've got at least available as cash for emergency repairs kind of thing? Or what's that percentage of what's that dollar value that you always keep aside as a buffer for this big portfolio?
Well, I guess that's actually varies between my wife and I. So, you know, I'm willing to take probably a little bit, well, a lot more risk than she is. So it's a constant discussion that we have in terms of what that amount should be.
A magical figure.
So, you know, that for me, I would be happy to sit on, you know, $5,000 in there, you know, taking that high level risk. But knowing that if something happens, I can, you know, immediately call on, you know, it might be a situation of doing some extra work, or it might be a situation where I know that the next month the money's going to come in. So you won't find that I'm comfortable that 30 properties won't just like blow up overnight. And, you know, I guess it'll be about managing the portfolio at that stage. So look, on a high level, I think I'd be comfortable with $20,000 in the bank account on a property portfolio of 30 for me. My wife is probably more comfortable with maybe 50,000 plus.
Right. So I have to say this, Luke, that you're a big risk taker with $20,000 as a backup in the... I probably won't be able to sleep, to be honest.
I take it back, you've got one life. So, you know, you obviously got to put a little bit of concentration on the buffers. I would say that most people that you... with a property portfolio, you probably want to be looking at more the $50,000 mark to be... the sleep at night factor is a big one for people. But, you know, I just take it back to, you've got one life, you've got to make the most of what you're doing. And if you know what you're doing and you feel that it is... you're moving in the right direction, why not take some calculated risks? And especially when times are good.
Sure. And how old are you, Luke, for the listeners who are starting out? So obviously you've built this decent sized portfolio. What age did you start it at, and what how old are you now?
I was 24 when I started, and I'm now 40. So
That's a pretty good work. Hey, really good stuff. Good on you. Hats off. So what's the plan with the portfolio from here, mate? You just want to keep sustaining this portfolio, or are you planning to grow the portfolio, or you want to sell down the line and pay off some of the debt? What's your plan with this portfolio?
Like I said earlier, you know, I'm probably a big picture person when it comes to thought. And, you know, I will say that the property portfolio will grow. That's a big one for me. I live and breathe property, as you said earlier. I've got an appetite for looking to learn and grow. And that comes more for me than the actual, you know, the money and the numbers. And it's about the experiences, the people involved, you know, who you can meet, what can you actually grow on. You know, I'm looking at all different scenarios for myself right now, whether that be renovations, whether it be small developments, large developments. I just purchased a quite a large development site, well, a small site as such, but it can actually go for 7 stories and 22 units. So that's up in Queensland. And then the opportunities of doing some private lending with other people. So it's growing that network is really more important for me than actually, you know, the wealth, you know, being a billionaire or, you know, whatever. Sure. Because it's, you know, I just think it's who you meet, the connections you have, the life that you want to lead over, you know, money.
So you're basically enjoying the journey. So it's you're enjoying that part, which is awesome, which is what I personally like as well about doing this stuff. And I'm sure David probably enjoys being part of this journey too. But that's really good, mate.
In terms of giving our listeners, what would be the 3 biggest lessons out of your journey to the 30 properties? What would be the 3 biggest things that you can contribute to our listeners if you are to do it again?
I would say, I use this acronym a lot. It's about turning on your tap. So have a team of people around you,
mm-hmm.
Action, take action.
Take action, yep.
And have some patience.
And have patience. You could probably create a movement out of it.
I like it.
I'll put a t-shirt in place for it.
Love it.
I like it. Tap. Team action.
Tap.
Patience, right? And also, what are some in today's where lending is obviously very hard these days compared to what it was 10, 15 years ago or even 5 years ago. What are some of the 3 big tips and tricks in today's market that you will give to the people?
Well, I guess it's about, you know, looking at your budgets. I would say personally that was something that I do personally. I focus on the buffer more, but some people need to actually put the budgets in place for them. So how do you reduce your expenses? How do you increase your income? You know, is it a side business that you do? Is it working overtime or by, you know, getting a second job? So I think that's a big one for people, of looking incoming expenses. I'd say in terms of, you know, meeting up with experienced mortgage brokers. There's all different kinds out there. You want to probably meet with someone who has a lot of experience, someone who can actually deal with certain clients better than others, and can actually look to get deals where other mortgage brokers can't.
Sure.
Look to affordable markets. It might be a situation where people are, over looking at just buying their own home. And in Sydney, for example, the median house price is over $1 million. Look to rent for a little while and, start your investment journey and buying $250,000 or $350,000 or $450,000 houses instead of that $1 million home. So you can get lending, might not be at $1 million for $1 million property, but it might be for a $250,000 property.
Sure. So rent vesting is another way, David and I did discuss that in our previous episode. That was all about rent vesting, and I used to do that as well. Surely do agree with that part as well.
I do it myself right now. So I rent where I want to live, and I continue to build my portfolio as much as the banks will allow me.
That's so. Are you still able to get lending out of the banks, or it's pretty much you're out?
Pretty much cut. As you can imagine, with 30 properties.
Sure, that's really good, mate. That covers a lot of stuff and passes on some really good tips and tricks to our listeners. Luke, anything else that you want to add for our listeners?
Thank you for having me on, and hopefully that helps the investors out there.
Sure, and also for the listeners, Luke is also a buyer's agent these days, and we'll bring him up on the show once again down the line to discuss more the buyer's advocacy side of things, how he's helping clients these days to purchase properties and build portfolio. Thanks for coming on the show once again to all our listeners. We really hope you guys are enjoying this podcast. We definitely are enjoying passing on the knowledge that we have, and plus learning new stuff at the same time, because we are in this space. We deal with the banks and the customers all the time, so we know what's going on in this space. If you like the episode, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on the iTunes, Podbean, wherever you're listening this, and we will see you guys next time. Chaz and David.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.